Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. This is a very interesting moment in the Trump presidency. He suddenly got two policies that are not reflexively right-wing and have Democrats offering cautious praise at the same time that several scandals seem to be growing in intensity. Maybe this is not even a coincidence. The New York Times reports that he is in talks with a lawyer who was on the Bill Clinton impeachment defense team and also represented Dick Cheney when Cheney was under investigation as George W. Bush's vice president. That's related to the Russia investigation and the campaign finance fraud aspect of Trump's alleged affair with porn star Stormy Daniels is intensifying, too. On the policies, Senator Elizabeth Warren, of all people, made the Sunday talk show rounds yesterday. And here's a minute of her offering praise to Trump for announcing a May meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But Warren also articulates some concerns, as you'll hear.
I am very glad to see the Trump administration turn in the direction of diplomacy. And the principal reason for that is because there is no military-only solution to North Korea. And this is not just what I say. This is what our own generals, who are experts in the area and responsible for the area, say. So that means we really do need strong diplomacy here. But these are very complex negotiations. So I'm very concerned about the fact that the State Department has so many vacancies that much of the staff at the State Department has been decimated. We have no ambassador right now to South Korea. The assistant secretary in charge of this area, that's another vacant post. And this is important because these are the people who know the economy, who know the language, who know the history, who know our military needs. So I am very concerned that the president may be taken advantage of here.
So Elizabeth Warren on Fox News Sunday there, and she gave the same kind of answer when asked about Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs. This is not no, it's kind of a yes, but.
I was very glad to see what the president had done. Look, I have been a critic for a long time about U.S. trade policy. My view is that we have negotiated one deal after another that has been great for big multinational corporations and been lousy for American workers, lousy for American small businesses, often not even good for American consumers. So what I'd like to see us do is rethink our whole trade strategy. And I'm not afraid of using tariffs as part of that trade strategy. And I was glad when, after I made that statement, that the president distinguished our allies from China and said, wait a minute, we have to do something different here. But you can't do this as just a little tiny piece of the economy or a small piece of the economy. It's got to be part of an overall trade strategy that puts American workers, American small businesses first. That's what I really want to see.
Elizabeth Warren on Fox News Sunday. She went on multiple shows yesterday as she runs for re-election in Massachusetts. And of course, everybody wanted to know if she's going to run for president in 2020. But some interesting praise with criticism from one of Trump's most unambiguous critics since he took office, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. And let's start there with USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. It's great to be with you.
So first on Elizabeth Warren, she kept evading the question of whether she's going to run for president in 2020. I heard her evade it on CNN State of the Union, NBC's Meet the Press, and Fox News Sunday. So why was she making the rounds of national Sunday shows if she didn't want to answer that question?
Well, because she, of course, wants to be asked that question, even if she isn't ready to answer it. She gave the same answer that she gave before the last presidential election, which is, I am not running for president. I'm not running for president. That would be in the present tense. She didn't say, I will never run for president in the future. You know, I think it's pretty clear that she wants to keep her profile raised, that she is interested at least in being in the mix for the 2020 presidential race, even if she has not made a decision on whether to run or not.
So how much did you hear those two answers we played as representative of Democrats more broadly? Kind of, yeah, we like accepting a peace overture from North Korea. And yeah, we like tariffs on cheating countries and outsourcing companies, but we have to couch it in criticism, too.
You know, this is one of the things that concerned Democrats when President Trump was elected, concerned them in a partisan way, that he had the potential to cut a path that would be problematic for Democrats. It wouldn't be kind of a classic Republican. It would be a Republican who had some populist instincts on things like trade. The president has mostly not delivered in ways that concern Democrats, that make it hard for Democrats to be on one side or the other. But on these issues, he has. It's hard to say it's a bad thing to talk to North Korea, realizing that there are some concerns and caveats with that. And also on trade, that was a very interesting response from Senator Warren, basically saying, yes, this is what I think we should be doing. We should be tougher on trade agreements to try to help American workers.
I see you have an analysis of the North Korea move in USA Today with your byline. And like some of what Warren was saying in the clip about her concerns, you note that some analysts expressed concern about whether the Trump administration was ready for the talks that are slated for May without the meticulous preparations that have marked previous rounds of negotiations. And maybe this is the most important part, without an experienced diplomatic team in place. The administration's top Korea expert recently resigned, and there's no U.S. ambassador in South Korea and no confirmed assistant secretary of state for Asia. I mean, that's kind of remarkable. So do they have anyone there with knowledge to prep him for this?
Well, I think it's as you said, an item of great concern for those who approach diplomacy as careers, because the State Department has really been hollowed out in many ways in the professional ranks, the career diplomats that provide advice and backup, and traditionally would be doing the initial reaching out to North Korea before talks like this. Now, at the White House, there is less concern about this, and they're. Basic argument might go something like this: that way didn't work. Let's try this way, which is basically let's rely on the instincts and negotiating skills of the president himself. This is clearly a different way to approach North Korea than previous administrations have done. It carries some perils, but it is hard to argue that the other approach, which resulted in agreements in the Clinton administration and in the George W. Bush administration that weren't held to, that North Korea broke, it worked particularly well either.
And I think it was Andrea Mitchell on Meet the Press. It was somebody on their roundtable who said when Kim talks about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, that's not just no North Korean nukes, but also no more U.S. nuclear umbrella protecting South Korea and Japan as it does now. So what sounds like an offer of ending his nuclear program in exchange for some kind of recognition, maybe a trick aimed at getting the U.S. to back off. And maybe Trump didn't understand that when he impulsively accepted that invitation to meet, surprising even his own officials who were in the room with the South Korean representative last week. Do you know about that language?
Well, it is true that denuclearization means different things to the two sides, because for the U.S., it's a shorthand for saying North Korea should get rid of its illegal rogue nuclear weapons program. That is not what it means to Pyongyang. And it would be great for Pyongyang to get rid of U.S. and South Korean nukes, right? Analysts also think it's unlikely. This seems like sort of a non-starter, right? The U.S. is never going to agree to that. That gives North Korea an out to say that they're not going to get rid of their nuclear program as well. So the odds are this negotiation doesn't work. It's hard to imagine that it does work. The question is, does it get us let us move away from the prospect of armed conflict, of a military showdown there, or does it move us closer to that? And I think we don't know the answer to that question yet.
Of course, if the language there that I attributed to what the North Korean position actually is were to come to pass, maybe that would be a good thing. Let's see all sides stand down on nuclear weapons. A lot of people in the nonproliferation movement might like that idea, but, maybe even Japan and South Korea.
But it would require a level of trust that it is just unfathomable at this point to imagine that we would have with North Korea.
And one other
we'd have to trust them to do what they said they were going to do.
Right.
And in the past, that has not been the case.
Well, there would need to be verification. I think they've made that clear. And that's always the case in these arms reduction agreements. So, yeah, I guess that's something that would have to be negotiated. And just one other thing on this before we move on to other things. Trump seemed to announce that as this is happening. I'm going to meet Kim Jong-un in May. Then his press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the next day seemed to put conditions on it and said they had to do something in North Korea in order for this meeting to actually happen. So is the meeting confirmed or is the meeting conditional?
Well, this was a surprise at the briefing. And the White House, by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and the White House then tried to kind of walk that back and say that the conditions were those that the president had laid out, which are really rather modest conditions. It's no nuclear testing before the meeting takes place, right? And it's allowing the military maneuvers that happen every year with South Korea to go forward, which they would anyway, but the North Koreans wouldn't protest them this year. So the conditions that the president said are pretty modest, and the White House, after this briefing, seemed to be indicating that those were the conditions that applied. But, you know, It is possible this meeting takes place. It's also possible it falls through because you have two leaders who can be pretty mercurial.
Listeners, our guest is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and we can take your phone calls with comments or questions on any of the things that we're talking about on Monday Morning Politics for this week. Trump and North Korea, Trump and tariffs, Trump's newest new position on guns, which we will get to in a minute, the scandals, the proceedings of the Russia investigation, the parts of the Stormy Daniels encounter that might involve financial wrongdoing, not just personal sexual behavior. Also, we'll get to one of the scariest things that Steve Bannon has ever said, and that is a very high bar, isn't it? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. There's more Trump policy news this morning on guns, as you know, Susan, and it involves at least one reversal of position from that televised meeting the other week where he seemed to take pro-gun control positions. Who was surprised that he didn't mean all of what he said there? Raise your hands. Here is what he said then about age limits to buy weapons.
Somebody can buy a handgun at 21.
Right.
Now, this is not a popular thing to say in terms of the NRA, but I'm saying it anyway. I'm going to just have to say it. But you can't buy, I mean, think of it. You can buy a handgun. You can't buy one. You have to wait till you're 21. But you can buy the kind of weapon used in the school shooting at 18. I think it's something you have to think about.
Would you sign that?
So, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give it a lot of consideration, and I'm the one bringing it up, and a lot of people don't even want to bring it up because they're afraid to bring it up.
Well, he didn't quite commit to raising the age limit on buying assault weapons. He said he's giving it a lot of consideration. But that was Trump on February 28th, 2 weeks after the Parkland shooting. This Wednesday will be 4 weeks. Susan, what's he saying now?
Well, he's not mentioning the idea of raising the age to 21 for certain firearms. You know, that public meeting he had with the survivors of school shootings was followed by a private White House meeting with leaders of the National Rifle Association. And since that meeting, we haven't heard the White House express so much enthusiasm about raising the age or some of the tougher measures that he talked about. He also talked about the idea of seizing guns from people who risk harming themselves or others and doing due process later. There was no talk of that either in the package of gun proposals that the White House put out last night.
And this package, maybe you can clarify this for me, because I saw this package referred to as a package of proposals, but also as a decision to appoint a commission to look into what needs to be done to end school shootings. And, you know government, when they appoint a commission to look into something, it's often an excuse for politicians not to take responsibility for any actions and not to actually do anything for a long time while their commission studies it. How much is this that?
You're such a cynic, Brian. I'm really sorry to hear you say these things.
Realist,
you know who expressed, you know who expressed a similar view of commissions? That would be Donald Trump on Saturday night in a campaign-style rally he did in Pennsylvania where he said, commissions are just an excuse to keep talking. I'm going to do something. And then 24 hours, the White House announces the formation of a commission that Education Secretary Betsy DeVos will be in charge of. It is true that, I mean, commissions, there are some commissions that have done good work, but often it is, in fact, a way to say you're doing something without actually standing up and doing something.
You mentioned the campaign-style rally in Pennsylvania. Let me throw in a question about that. I guess there's going to be one of these special congressional elections tomorrow in a district in Pennsylvania, and this is a district that Trump won by 20 points in the presidential election, but this race is considered close. So Trump went there to campaign for this Republican candidate. If he won by 20 points, but this is going to be seen potentially as a bellwether of how people feel about him today, why did he put his prestige on the line by campaigning for this, what he considers, I think, a subpar Republican candidate this weekend?
Well, you know, there have been, this will be the sixth special House election in districts that Trump won. And the Republican candidate has won the previous five, despite some high hopes by Democrats. So he may be thinking, well, why not try to extend the victories that he's had in these special House elections. Democrats are really optimistic about this one because the Republican candidate, Rick Saccone, is considered not a very good candidate. The Democratic candidate, Connor Lamb, is considered a very good candidate. He was a Marine. He was a federal prosecutor. He stood up against Nancy Pelosi, says he won't support her for House leader. So in some ways, he is not a traditional Democrat running in this Republican-leaning district. And Democrats hope that they'll win it, and Republicans have pumped a ton of money into this race. This is a district that won't even exist in November because their courts have ordered Pennsylvania to redraw their lines. But both sides are very invested in this race. Happens tomorrow. We'll see who wins.
Why is the Democratic candidate denouncing Nancy Pelosi or saying he wouldn't vote for her for a leader? Is she too liberal for this district? Is she too female for this candidate? What is it?
Well, you may not be aware, but she's from San Francisco.
And I've heard of it.
Yes, and
nice city.
San Francisco liberal. She's been a very effective leader in the House, but that's come with some cost to her reputation. She's become kind of the iconic Democrat for Republicans to attack, and so I think that's why you see a lot of ads against Nancy Pelosi in districts, which seems perplexing to me because I'm assuming a lot of Americans have no idea who she is or why they should be for or against her.
Right, but it's not immediately clear to you why this particular Democratic candidate is distancing himself from her.
Oh.
In terms of specific policies or anything like that.
I don't know. I'm assuming it's politically helpful to him.
Yeah,
but there may be some particular issue that I'm not aware of.
Let's take a phone call. Mike in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Just returning to North Korea. It seems to me in a lot of the analysis I've read, people are overlooking one simple fact, and that the countries coming together are all basically autocracies. You have Russia, China, North Korea, and now, you know, Trump, who said that he basically wants to be a dictator for life. So it seems to be a triumph of the autocrats.
Well, he will be quick to point out that he was making a joke about now that China's president is setting himself up for indefinite rule, maybe we should try something like that here. He was saying it in a joking context, so we'll give him that at least. Even the fact that he feels that autocracy is a joking matter is a troubling indication. And Susan, this is one of the conundrums on how to deal with North Korea or any autocratic leader, right? It's how much the U.S. should be concerned with democracy and human rights in other countries versus overlooking those things and just focusing on how much of a threat to us they may be.
And, of course, that's one reason that we have never had a face-to-face meeting between the leader of North Korea and the president of the United States in the past, because it lends a legitimacy to that regime that it doesn't deserve. Now, this White House has made a different calculation when it comes to dealing with North Korea, but that has been a really defining dilemma for previous administrations.
And of course, Trump has been full of praise for people who, it horrifies many that he's full of praise for, who are autocrats or trying to even shift countries from being more democratic to more autocratic, like the leaders of Turkey and the Philippines, and of course, Vladimir Putin. And one wonders what he might come out of a meeting with Kim Jong-un saying. This is, you know, generally perceived to be the worst government in the world with respect to how it treats its own people. And what if they come up with a denuclearization deal of some kind or progress toward one that Trump wants to continue? Does he come out in the way that he does sometimes after meeting with these kinds of leaders saying, you know, he's a very smart guy, or some other kind of praise like that, that makes it worse for the people in North Korea?
You know, I think that is something that's happened already. I think announcing that you're accepting Kim's invitation to meet with him face-to-face has elevated the North Korean regime in a way it's never been elevated before. If it results in progress, if it makes the situation on the Korean Peninsula less problematic, then it will have been worth it. Remember that when President Obama was leaving office, his message to President-elect Trump was, this is the worst problem you're going to have, the most dangerous place on earth. So if you can make it a little less dangerous, we'll all be in favor of that. But it doesn't come without some costs, including lending legitimacy to this regime.
Matt in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. Has there been any confirmation of the rumor that Russians prevented Romney from becoming Trump's Secretary of State?
Oh, that was a report recently, right. And I don't remember the origin of this. Susan, tell me if you do, that Putin or somebody in his government, because Romney, if we remember Romney when he was running against Obama for president in 2012, and he was in one of those debates and asked, what's the biggest national security threat facing the United States? He said Russia. And Obama poo-pooed that answer at the time, but obviously Mitt Romney didn't make any friends in the Putin regime with that answer, just like Hillary Clinton didn't make any friends in the Putin regime, and that was why they were so out to get her defeated. So the report recently is that when Romney was considered for Secretary of State by Trump, and then he didn't get the job, that Putin had something to do with it. Do you know anything about that, Susan?
One of the realities of the Trump administration is that there is so much news to cover that you can never possibly cover it all.
I hear that.
And this was a very tantalizing report, but I don't know if it's been confirmed. I would just note that it wasn't just Donald Trump who poo-pooed Mitt Romney when he said Russia was the biggest foreign policy challenge. It was a lot of reporters, including myself, and I would say that Mitt Romney turns out to look a little smarter there than we would have thought.
Yeah. Wasn't just Obama who poo-pooed it at that time, yes. Let's go on to some of the scandal news. First, who's this lawyer the New York Times has four sources saying Trump is talking to?
Well, his name is Emmett Flood, and he's one of the most prominent, if not publicly known, lawyers in town. He worked for Clinton during impeachment. He worked for George W. Bush in the White House counsel's office. He worked for Dick Cheney. He is very skilled at helping high officials who face legal troubles. And the New York Times reported that he met with President Trump last week, and they talked about him coming onto the White House counsel staff. It's not clear if that's going to happen. I think it is a sign that President Trump does not think this investigation is going to be over soon, the special counsel's investigation. You know, as Ty Cobb had said, going to be done by Thanksgiving, going to be done by the end of the year, 2017, going to be done earlier this year. None of that seems to be true. So just the fact that he's talking to lawyers about coming on board may be a sign that he thinks he's in for a more extended investigation than he thought. One other thing this might indicate is if Democrats win control of the House in November, which is not assured but possible, that there would be an increased possibility of impeachment proceedings, and that is something Emmett Flood has some experience with.
And the White House denies that the Times story is accurate, but we should note the Times story does not say that Trump has decided to hire that lawyer. They just say that, in fact, it says that they haven't decided whether or not to hire that lawyer, just that they have four sources, the Times does, that that says that they're talking to him. And on Stormy Daniels, I see your paper, USA Today, has a story about what kind of bank account Trump's lawyer paid her hush money from. What's that about?
Well, the lawyer who handled this, Michael Cohen, handled it for Trump, says that he took out a home equity line to pay the $130,000. Now, we don't know if that was we just don't know whether he ever got reimbursed by Trump. We don't know kind of the nature of this payment, but it raises, not only is it kind of weird on its own, because I don't know if you've dealt with your lawyer. My lawyer would probably not take out a home equity line to pay off some debt that was helpful to me. But it also raises the questions about whether this payment could amount to an illegal campaign contribution. And it would be sort of ironic indeed if President Trump's biggest legal troubles turned out to be from something like that.
Trump denies the affair, but I read that Trump was unhappy with his press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, when she confirmed a legal proceeding involving them last week in this answer at a press briefing.
Look, the president has addressed these directly and made very well clear that none of these allegations are true. This case has already been won in arbitration, and anything beyond that, I would refer you to the president's outside counsel.
So what did she mean by this case has already been won in arbitration?
Well, we didn't know when she said that what she meant, but it turns out what she meant was that that Michael Cohen managed to get a temporary restraining order against Stormy Daniels late last month because through an arbitration procedure, which was part of the agreement, the hush money agreement that she had signed. But interestingly, also Trump had not signed, apparently. So this is Sarah Huckabee Sanders opened the door to some information we didn't have before that I think the White House thinks has not been helpful.
It's not just Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, who could be in legal trouble over this. It's Trump himself, potentially, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it could have been an illegal campaign contribution to his campaign. Also, it's possible that Trump reimbursed Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen has said that the Trump organization didn't pay him for it, but he hasn't addressed whether Trump personally paid for it. So there continue to be questions about this. And Stormy Daniels, or Stephanie Clifford, her actual name, so shows no signs of going away. She's done an interview with 60 Minutes. We're waiting to see if that airs despite this agreement that she signed.
And let me play, before we run out of time, a clip of Steve Bannon speaking in France over the weekend. And I know Steve Bannon isn't with the administration anymore, but Bannonism and Trumpism overlap to a huge degree. And I mean, my jaw dropped. You know, it's hard to surprise me with anything that Steve Bannon might say, but he spoke to supporters, I guess, of the French nationalist Marine Le Pen. And listen to these 30 seconds.
Let them call you racist.
Laissez-vous appeler raciste.
Let them call you xenophobes.
Mais laissez-vous appeler xénophobes.
Let them call you nativist.
Laissez-vous les appeler nativistes.
Wear it as a badge of honor.
Portez-le comme un badge d'honneur.
Because every day we get stronger and they get weaker.
So now we know how to say let them call you racist in French, as obviously he was speaking to that crowd through a translator. But let them call you racist and nativist and wear it as a badge of honor, Susan, my God.
Because we are getting stronger and they are getting weaker, and that
oh
will
my
be
God.
A test. You know, this is a very far
the white
right
people
group.
Are getting stronger and the people
yeah.
of color get, is that what he's saying?
Well, he's saying that the nativists, which is in fact a label that he uses for himself, are getting stronger. And that's one of the things we're going to find out in November. We're going to find out if the Steve Bannon approach to American politics is in fact getting stronger or whether it's getting weaker. It's, you know, the fact is President Trump won the White House with a message that was shaped in part by Steve Bannon, although, as you know, he's left the White House staff now. And we'll see whether this is a rising tide in American politics or one that was a kind of one-off and will now ebb. But this group, the National Front, is quite a notorious group in French politics. This was not, he was not speaking to the Republican Party of France.
I'm still shuddering listening to that clip. Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.